You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We get a glimpse inside South Yorkshire Police to hear how one man believes 96 Liverpool fans died at the Hillsborough disaster. Yes, we go back over 20 years to the Sheffield's Hillsborough disaster, where 96 Liverpool fans were crushed to death, then had the indignity of being wrongly blamed by Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper. But many survivors and victims' families believe the whole truth has still not come out, and one former South Yorkshire police employee has submitted an extraordinary witness statement to the current Hillsborough inquiry panel. He tells me of a conversation he had in the police canteen that paints a disturbing picture of how events unfolded that day. Plus, the Occupy Bristol campsite has sprung up on College Green this week. What's it all about? Tom Baldwin's here from the Youth Fight for Jobs campaign to explain about that and also tell us of plans for a new Jarrow March against mass unemployment. And on a similar theme, local disabled people will be marching tomorrow against government cuts to disabled benefits. Tara Melton and Jenny Hodges explain how the coalition government's cuts are affecting the most vulnerable in our society. And SHWAG is the NHS, is a privatised organisation. As it's being privatised, this new organisation is being set up to support health service whistleblowers. And where is Werity? That was the headline in a Daily Mail article this week about the invisible advisor and the resignation of Defence Secretary and North Somerset Conservative MP Liam Fox. Martin Summers explains the backstory of what looks like a mole at the heart of the Ministry of Defence. But first, the Hillsborough disaster was a human crush that occurred on Saturday the 15th of April 1989 at the home of Sheffield Wednesday Football Club, the Hillsborough Football Stadium. The human compress resulted in the deaths of 96 people, with no fewer than 766 Liverpool fans being injured at the same time. It remains the deadliest stadium-related disaster in British history and one of the worst ever international football accidents. The match, an FA Cup semi-final tie between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, was abandoned 6 minutes into the game. The official inquiry into the disaster, the Taylor Report, concluded that the main reason for the disaster was the failure of police control. The findings of the report resulted in the elimination of standing terraces at all major football stadia in both England and Scotland, and it's a story that refuses to go away. It was discussed in the Commons this week, and in yesterday's Guardian, the Liverpool manager Kenny Dalglish criticised a retired judge for suggesting the families of Hillsborough victims should move on and drop their conspiracy theories. Sir Oliver Popplewell, who chaired the public inquiry into the 1985 fire at the Valley Parade Stadium, which killed 56 people, called on the Liverpool families to look at the quiet dignity and great courage that relatives of the Bradford victims have shown in the years following the tragedy. Dalglish offered a dismissive response, that's the Liverpool manager. Who is he? Why should he make someone else's mind up? Said Dalglish. He was a manager at the time of the 1989 disaster too. I don't think he should be interfering. It's not comparable. Each one is equally important to the people who've been involved in it as the other. And he went on, I don't know who the guy is or what he said, but certainly the Hillsborough families have been hugely complimented on their dignity and how they've gone about what they want to achieve. Our families, Dalglish continued, have been fantastically dignified in their approach and also, after 22 years, very patient. And at least they deserve is some comfort. Well, one man who profoundly disagrees with Sir Oliver Popplewell's call for victims' friends and families to give up their search for the truth is Tony Farrell. Tony used to work for South Yorkshire Police and has submitted a witness statement to the present inquiry panel. When I spoke to him a few days ago, I asked him what he said in his witness statement.
I'm Tony Farrell, and I used to be the Principal Intelligence Analyst of South Yorkshire Police. On Monday, there was a parliamentary debate on disclosure issues of Hillsborough, 22 years on, under the 30-year rule that was concerning the Thatcher files and minutes that were taken in collaboration with senior management for South Yorkshire Police, my old employers. Now, first thing to say, I was not working for South Yorkshire Police in 1989. I was in Sheffield, and I used to be a Liverpool supporter, but I wasn't that interested in football. I was more a rugby man. And Hillsborough never came on my radar. as a principal intelligence analyst. But in 2009, something very interesting happened on the week of the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough. And I was sat in the canteen headquarters in Snig Hill in Sheffield, police headquarters, when the press officer, Andy Hymas, came and sat by me. He looked a bit worn out, actually. He looked as though he'd had time in the morning. And he come and sat down, and I said, "What's up, Andy?" And he said, "I've just been in with the chief constable who's faced a grilling from the press about Hillsborough, and this would have been 20 years on. Now, Andy was in the stadium on the day, and he duly offloaded over lunch. His story was this. He was outside the stadium just before kick-off as the press officer, and he was told from on high to find out what on earth was going on in the stadium, in particular get himself ASAP to the control room within the stadium itself at Hillsborough, where the CCTV would have been kept and police officers and the command team would have been looking at things. Now clearly this was at the time when the crush was starting and all hell was being let loose in the pen, where the gates had been opened and the crush had started and people were clearly distressed and subsequently led to 96 people losing their lives. Now Andy made his way to the control room as directed, and when he got to the control room, Andy said this is what happened. He tried to get in. Inside were police officers, and the police officers were very reluctant to let him in and told him to go away. Well, Andy sought advice from on high and was told to get in no uncertain terms and find out what on earth was going on. So ultimately, Andy managed to get inside the control room, and it was when he was inside the control room he realised why they were not prepared to let him in the first place. And the reason was this. Within the control room where all the CCTV was unfolding and the horror of Hillsborough, while that was unfolding, the most senior officer on the day, which was an ACC, Walter Jackson, was in the control room, but he was underneath the table behaving like a gibbering wreck. So he was clearly distressed at what he was unfolding. And the reason why Andy wasn't allowed in was because the police officers were trying to protect his compromised position. So Andy told me this story, and at the time he told me it, I looked at him and we had a philosophical talk about it, and I thought to myself at the time, what would I have done if I'd have been in command, and there but for the grace of God go we. So I wasn't being judgmental at that stage, but I wasn't attuned to the disclosure issues and the discontent of the families of Hillsborough at the time. So I was never tasked to look at Hillsborough, so I quickly forgot about it. Now, 6 or 7 weeks ago, Tony, my friend David Pidcock alerted me to the fact that the chief constable had been in trouble again with communication about Hillsborough that had upset the Hillsborough family support group, and in particular a lady called Margaret Aspinall. So I couldn't resist, in the circumstances I'm in with South Yorkshire Police in my employment tribunal, and naturally researched what that was about. And in so doing, I understood where Margaret Aspinall from the Hillsborough Family Support Group was coming from. She was talking about the insensitive remarks that were made by the Chief Constable, in particular in relation to the 30-year rule about disclosure, and the fact that 22 years on, and that there's still secret files that have been hidden. And there was some squabble between the coroner of Sheffield and the Chief Constable. Now, what that did to me, I watched a video of Margaret Aspinall addressed the Hillsborough Family Support Group on the 22nd anniversary, in which she made an impassioned call for full disclosure, saying that unless we get disclosure of the truth, which we know we've not had, then we'll never be able to heal and move on, and that's all we asked for, and we know we haven't had it. It reminded me then of the tale that Andy Hymas told me in 2009, and I thought about it in a different context. I suddenly saw it from a perspective, what a cover-up. That would have never been disclosed. And I know it would have never been disclosed immediately, because ACC Jackson, the person we're talking about who lost it underneath the table as a gibbering wreck, got away from Hillsborough with his reputation unblemished. He continued to work as an assistant chief constable for South Yorkshire Police up until 1995. I myself joined the service in 1993. Now, given that he was still in service, to my mind, it's an utter disgrace that was never disclosed, because And I knew it hadn't been disclosed, because if it had been disclosed, it's inconceivable that the ACC would have been able to remain in position with his position unblemished for as long as he did when he retired in 1995. I felt as though that was a monstrous cover-up to protect the reputation of South Yorkshire Police. And suddenly, now that I was attuned to the plight of Liverpool, and don't forget, Tony, that Liverpool bore the brunt of a lot of criticism, unfairly, as a result of messages that were put out early by South Yorkshire Police that were fed in through to the Sun newspaper and Murdoch's paper, that unfairly criticised Liverpool fans for being drunk and for getting up to all sorts and for actually hammering the gates down on the day, which was an untruth initially put out by a senior commander, Duckenfield, who was there on the day. So there was clearly evidence at the time of some cover-up of statements, that statements had been changed. But this example with Walter Jackson is, to my mind, a stark example of the extent to which the police will go to cover up their own reputations. To my mind, that situation, warts and all, should have been disclosed. Not to condemn a man who on the day crumbled, but the crime of this, the evil part of this, is the fact that it's been covered up. It was covered up then, it's been covered up ever since, 22 years on. And when, in 2009, the Chief Constable, Med Hughes, went on an interview with The Guardian that is freely available on YouTube, he clearly states, Tony, that if there's anything to disclose on Hillsborough, he will disclose it. He is there to tell the truth. Well, I find that quite duplicitous in the circumstances, because to my mind it's inconceivable that the Chief Constable of South Yorkshire Police in 2009, who was fronting the press about Hillsborough, didn't know exactly what happened in 1989 with respect to an assistant Chief Constable in the control room on the day. And the very fact that that's been covered up is just an example of the extent to which they'll go to. Now, that needs, to my mind, exposing. There is an independent panel at the moment that's being run, that's looking at all the issues of disclosure. And I hope and pray that the story that I've related and that I've put forward as a witness statement will actually be told and will not be put to the bottom of the pile and archived off as irrelevant. What I think should happen is that the guy, Andy Hymas, the press officer who told me that story, should ultimately be subpoenaed to verify that what he told me was correct and whether it squared up indeed with his statement that he would have had to give on the day. Also, the police officers who would have been in the control room on the day, what statements did they put down? Did they hide up what was happening with Walter Jackson? And Walter Jackson himself should be called to be interviewed to account for himself on the day. And I know for a fact now, Tony, having spoken to Sheila Coleman, the head of the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, and Trevor Hicks and Margaret Aspinall, who lost loved ones on the day, that the witness statements that have been written up bear no resemblance to the story that Andy Hymas told me in 2009. And I know for the fact that Andy Hymas, when he told me that story, had no reason whatsoever to fabricate the truth. So it's a story he told me, it's a story I believe to be the truth, and I've no reason to doubt it. But it's a sad story and an indictment on South Yorkshire Police.
Well, that was former Chief Intelligence Analyst at the South Yorkshire Police, Tony Farrell, there, speaking to me a few days ago about the story told in the South Yorkshire Police Headquarters canteen that points to grave allegations that the senior police officer and his colleagues covered up his role in the Hillsborough disaster.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, local disabled people will be marching tomorrow against government cuts to the disabled benefits. Tara Melton and Jenny Hodges are with me now to explain how the coalition government's cuts are affecting the most vulnerable in society. Hi, Tara and Jenny, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, hi.
Now, you first, Tara. Can you just explain what you do at the Royal National Institute for the Blind?
So, RNIB, I am a campaigns officer for the South West. So I support blind and partially sighted people to engage with local decision making and local campaigning. But my role here today is I'm one of the co-organisers for the Hardest Hit event, which is happening tomorrow. It's one of 12 events that are happening across the UK.
So who are the Hardest Hit?
So the hardest hit are disabled people at the moment through a number of means. So it's a combination of local cuts, it's a combination of national cuts that are impacting on benefits which support disabled people to live their everyday life and to be independent.
So can you just go through some of the changes that are coming through? Now, we all know that there's this massive cuts programme. Mm. What we don't necessarily know is the detail about how this is affecting the disabled people, who, after all, are some of the most vulnerable in our society.
Yeah, absolutely. So many disabled people at the moment are living in fears of cuts to essential benefits, including disability living allowance, which is a non-means-tested benefit, which is there to support disabled people with the extra costs of living, of being disabled. So I'm sure Jenny will be able to tell you about some of those costs that she incurs. So that might be having to catch a taxi but not being able to access buses or to walk. It could be for some visually impaired people who have to spend a lot of money on lighting. Extra electricity and aids and adaptations around the home that help to support disabled people to be independent as possible. So there's some changes to that, and there's also some changes to and the employment support allowance. So I can tell you a bit about that. But
what is the employment support allowance? It sounds to me as if that's a little bit of money that you get to, in order to help you apply for jobs and that kind of thing, or once you get a job.
Yeah, so absolutely. So at the moment, people have been transferred from the incapacity benefit over into employment support allowance. It's quite a complicated benefit, but what people are being now is they're being reassessed to see if they're capable of being fit for work. So many disabled people are living in fear now of this reassessment, because many people are being found to be fit to work, but actually when they challenge that decision, it's been found actually they're not fit to work. So it's costing the government a lot of money. There's another part of that. There's a part called the Contributory Employment Support Allowance. So this is where people have already paid into the system, and then they are supported to be able to find work. They're found fit for work, and then they're trying to find back into the job market. But the government wants to limit that to 12 months. And we've heard a number of stories from disabled people who said 12 months is not enough time to get back into the workplace. So after that, then it goes back to being means tested and they're moved over to Job Seekers Allowance.
Now, one of the things that bothers me, Tara, is that people are being going through these interviews being told that they're fit for work when actually they aren't, and they have to then go through some kind of actually what might be an arduous appeal process, and suddenly the onus is on a disabled person to actually prove that they're not fit to work.
Absolutely, and one of the things that we're calling for from the government is actually for them to have a look at the employment support allowance and to make sure that it works by improving the assessment process so that people aren't scared, so they actually get to know the person and about their disability.
So what's wrong with the assessment process? I'm really crossing my fingers here and hoping that there aren't people out there who are assessing disabled people with some kind of financial motive to find that they are fit for work when they're actually not.
Well, I think there is this emphasis that out there, assumption that most people who are disabled don't want to work, that they're fit to work and they're just pretending they can't without actually understanding what the is. So one of the things that the person might have to do is to lift a box. So I was speaking to somebody who's a member of RNIB the other day who said he has a vision impairment and says, I could lift a box. I couldn't see the box to lift it. I don't know where I'm supposed to lift it to, but I can lift it. What does that mean? What does that actually mean to be fit to work because you can lift a box? So it's about actually re-looking at the assessment process and making sure that there's much more understanding, and also understanding that disabilities fluctuate, so somebody might be able to do something one day but not necessarily the following day. So it's actually having better understanding.
Now, we're also joined by Jenny Hodges. Jenny, welcome to Drive Time. It's lovely to have you here. Now, can you just give us a little picture of your story? How did you come to be disabled?
Sadly, I was driving home from a friend's one night and a drunk driver drove straight into me. So, bang, straight over an eye, I was left blind.
Crikey. Well, you know, how did you then cope with that? Were you able to get over it and then finally get back to looking for work, even though you're blind?
I have looked for a bit of work. Obviously, I had quite a road to recovery, but I have looked for jobs and I just haven't had any luck.
Now, what's your experience of going through the job search? It must be, I mean, there's all sorts of difficulties, obviously, in even looking for jobs when you're blind, but yeah. also, you know, going through the experience of being shortlisted and being interviewed. And what's your experience of employers?
Well, personally, I've never even got that far as being interviewed, because as soon as you say you're blind, they say, well, you couldn't do the job.
Okay.
And that's sort of how I've been left.
I mean, do you sit there and think, then, what kind of work could I do, despite the fact of being blind?
Yes. I mean, one Christmas, I did look into working in a chocolate factory, just filling up a box of chocolates, and I was advised I couldn't do it. Whereas I thought I probably could.
Okay. Well, you're in the situation now where you know, you're one of the people who these benefits are actually changing. How is it actually affecting you personally?
Well, it could personally affect lots of things, because I don't really like going out on my own. I'm sort of quite scared about going out. So therefore, certain times of night times, I would rather get in a taxi. That obviously costs money. Certain equipment that you need to help you live independently, like Tara was saying, you have to buy it. Talking watches, you have to buy. Liquid level indicators just to make a hot cup of tea or coffee, you have to buy. Everything costs, you know, a few quid. So you've just got to spend money all the time.
Well, what's the effect, though, when you hear on the radio or wherever you hear it that, you know, there are going to be cuts to your benefits?
Well, it can be very frightening, because you don't know how you're going to live.
So, Tara, can you maybe go into this a little bit? Because I think there is a certain amount of uncertainty about whether a particular person is going to get a particular benefit, how it's going to affect them. I mean, we've had this also, of course, with the closure of elderly people's care homes. Mm. It has a massive psychological impact sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, many people are living in fear of cuts to their essential benefits at the moment. And the total cuts will actually mean an estimated £9 billion loss to disabled people and their families' income over the next 4 years, so that's the government period of time. So this is obviously a deeply worrying time for people. And as Jenny said, with the disability living allowance, there's some essential changes to it where they're taking away the lower level of care. So DLA is going to become something called a personal independent payment. And at the moment, there's three levels of the care component, and they're going to take away the lower level of that, but we don't know what that criteria is going to mean. So it could potentially mean that lots of people who now receive the lower level care component won't be receiving that in the future.
So if you don't know what's going to happen, how are disabled people going to know? And of course, the end result of this is an extreme nervousness, not knowing if they're actually going to be able to survive in the future.
Yeah, absolutely, which is why disabled people from across the southwest, and this is one of event of 12 happening across the UK, why disabled people are coming together to say a number of things. One, no cuts to services that are vital to disabled people. Two, that the government needs to ensure that changes to DLA do not make disabled people worse off. The government made a commitment that disabled people wouldn't be worse off, but it doesn't seem like they're keeping to that commitment. That the government need to ensure that employment support allowance works by improving the assessment process. And they need to ensure that the welfare system supports people with additional cost of living with a disability. And we need those promises from government, and we're just not having them at the moment.
But do you agree that actually there do need to be cuts? And clearly the disabled support budget is a massive budget, and you know, it needs to be cut just like other budgets do.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions around disability living allowance and people sort of claiming it. There's only less than 0.1% or something of fraudulent claims. And so we're not saying, you know, who should be getting them, who shouldn't, but we're saying that disabled people, as we've heard from Jenny, there's those additional costs. And I think as a society, we should be making sure that disabled people have enough money to live, and that we all live together and we support each other. So we're not telling the government what they should be cutting and what they shouldn't. What we should be saying is they made a commitment to make sure that disabled people weren't being worse off, and I think they need to honour that commitment. And that's why disabled people feel so strongly about it, that they're coming together across the country to march and protest. And not everybody's going to be able to make the protest. We've had numbers of calls from people saying, I really support what you're doing, but I can't come there because I can't travel, I can't afford it. So it's just a small representation of disabled people tomorrow, but it still will be big numbers.
But what about the fact that last May in the election, we voted for this Liberal Conservative alliance, and we, as a society, decided to put them in power to make decisions like this, which include, potentially anyway, cuts?
Well, I think that nobody thought that disabled people were going to be worse off, and these changes that are happening, in clearly by the research that's been carried out, that £9 billion lost to disabled people and their families' incomes, do show that disabled people are financially going to be worse off. And that's why disabled people are coming together to say no, the new government needs to stop and they need to rethink what they're doing.
So Jenny, are you going to be going tomorrow?
Oh yes, I should be there.
And why is that? Why do you feel so strongly yourself?
What? Just because it will have an effect on an awful lot of people, just to have a bit of a life, really. Because, you know, we all need money, obviously. But when you are disabled, you've got other needs for sort of care and, you know, personal care and things. And just lots of things that you just have to spend more money on so you can live independently.
Okay, and Tara, can you just tell us where and when it's taking place?
So, it's taking place at College Green tomorrow. The march starts at 12 o'clock midday, so people are assembling at College Green from 9:30 onwards. We're going to march from College Green, and then we're doing a loop that comes back to College Green, and then there's a rally from 1:15 to 2:15.
And can you just tell us a bit about your campaign and whereabouts people can find you and where you are on the internet,
absolutely,
if people want to find out more?
Yeah, you can go to www.hardesthit.org.uk, or you can join the conversation online at www.facebook.com/thehardesthit, or you can use your hashtag hardesthit on Twitter.
Sounds to me like you're pretty teched up.
Indeed.
All right, well, I wish you well for tomorrow, and thanks very much. That's Tara Melton from the RNIB and Jenny Hodges for driving us? No! For joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thank you very much.
We have some music now, and after that, it's College Green and a little camp that's sprung up in a kind of Occupy Wall Street fashion in Bristol. I'll tell you what I'm going to play you, and that is a folk song. It's by a group from 1970. See if you can figure out how this might relate to a subject we'll be discussing a little bit later in the programme, that is the resignation of Liam Fox. And this is Bob and Carol Pegg from 1970, and the title of the song is Mr. Fox.
I should marry him, that I should be his bride, and
gruesome end there, with his flesh being eaten by the birds of the air. That's Mr. Fox from 1970. Martin Summers is joining me. Martin, can you just give us some of your, to a certain degree, your take on the whole Adam Werrity story? It's one of the most peculiar, weirdest things I've seen. The idea that this guy is wandering around, sort of holding hands with the Defence Secretary, going into the Ministry of Defence, going on foreign trips, and yet nobody seems to know anything about him, and he hasn't even got the very most basic levels of security clearance.
No, and in actual fact, I think that's why the civil servants have grasped all this up. It's not just that Werrity's a Walter Mitty character, as Liam Fox has, or some people have suggested. Werrity and Fox are funded by very powerful people who are pushing a very far-right agenda and a very pro-Israel agenda. And of course we find out from this week that Dr. Fox and Mr. Werrity met the head of Mossad, which is the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service. So you've got some people who are basically very close to the Israeli Secret Intelligence Services, no security clearance in the British Ministry of Defence, wandering around privy to all sorts of discussions that are going on at all sorts of levels with foreign governments. In other words, basically Fox has allowed somebody who is from basically connected to Mossad access to Ministry of Defence secret meetings. And also, of course, is also suggested that Fox allowed somebody from the CIA to wander around inside the Ministry of Defence, again with no security clearance. And you've got to remember that the Tory right wing is heavily funded by Israeli millionaires and billionaires and by right wing forces in the United States of America. And this, of course, is what's underlying all of this, is secret lobbying by powerful, wealthy interests. That's what's underlying all of this. It's not a series of faux pas and social mistakes. There's a very serious issue here.
Well, Liam Fox, he resigned last Friday, about half an hour before this programme started, and this week he came to the House of Commons to give a resignation speech, and here's an extract from that now.
I accept that it was a mistake to allow distinctions to be blurred between my professional responsibilities and my personal loyalty to a friend. I accepted then it was a mistake to attend a meeting with a potential supplier without an official present. And with hindsight, I should have been more willing to listen to concerns of those around me. I would like to say again that I am very sorry to my colleagues here in the House and to all those who feel let down by the decisions I have made. I have always believed in personal responsibility and accept the Cabinet Secretary's conclusions. I am pleased at the explicit acknowledgement that I neither sought, expected, nor received any financial gain. That was being widely and wrongly implied. I also welcome the clarification of the fact that no national security issues were breached, no classified documents made available, and no classified matters briefed. These accusations were also widely made and deeply hurtful. The ministerial code has been found to be breached, and for this, I'm sorry. I accept that it's not only the substance, but perception that matters, and that is why I chose to resign. I accept the consequences for me without bitterness or rancour. Yeah. But just as these events can bring out the worst in human nature, they also bring out the best. I have been touched and frankly overwhelmed by huge numbers of letters, emails and calls from friends and strangers alike, in particular from my constituents in North Somerset. It has meant more to me than anyone can know.
That was Liam Fox in his resignation speech in the House of Commons earlier this week. North Somerset MP and former Secretary of State for Defence. Martin, really what he's saying there is that he's resigned because of the way that this whole business with Werrity was perceived. And he's also pointing out that there was no financial gain from his point of view, and national security was never compromised.
I think the national security not being compromised is only on the basis that everything we do is open to the Israelis anyway. The Israelis are our allies. That's what Fox believes. And he's been in Israel saying that Israel is our ally and that we support them 100%. Now, in other words, that isn't actually the British government's position. It's not the Foreign Office's position. And in fact, Fox has had to resign to protect the rest of the cabinet and to protect Cameron. That's the only reason he's gone. In actual fact, there's plenty of other cabinet ministers who've got similar people floating around whispering in their ears. And of course, Fox resigning means that no further investigation will be made of those people. But of course, basically, this Tory government is stocked with lobbyists from the arms industry, from foreign powers like the Israelis and by the Americans. And if you looked at where the money trail leads, it leads back to those people.
Now, it was also raised at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week when there was an exchange between Ed Miliband and David Cameron on this very issue.
Mr. Speaker, the revelations over the last week about what has been going on in the most sensitive department at the heart of the Prime Minister's government are deeply worrying. The former Defence Secretary had an unofficial adviser with access to top officials in the military and indeed foreign governments, funded by undeclared private donations solicited by him. Yet the Prime Minister says he and Number 10 knew nothing about these goings-on for 18 months. How did he allow this to happen?
Well, first of all, I agree with the right honourable gentleman. This is an important and serious issue, and that is why I set up a full and proper inquiry by the Cabinet Secretary, and he's produced that report, and the report has been published in full. And I do think it's worth, Mr. Speaker, actually recognising that in this case, the Secretary of State for Defence recognised that he had made a mistake, acknowledged that he broke the ministerial code, and he resigned. That is not something that always happened in the last 13 years.
Miliband!
Mr. Speaker, a piece of advice to the Prime Minister. This week of all weeks, show a bit of humility, eh? Yeah. And the truth is, we still don't know the full facts about this case, about the money trail, about who exactly in the government met Mr. Werity. And it is becoming clear that there are a network of individuals who funded Mr. Werity, some with close links to the Conservative Party and other members of the Cabinet. Now, given that he says he knew nothing about the arrangements of the former Defence Secretary, can he now give this House a categorical guarantee that over the last 18 months, no other government minister has been engaging in similar activities?
I think we should have a little bit of humility from the people who gave us cabs for hire, passports for favours, mortgages for mates, dodgy dossiers, smearing opponents, good days to very bad news. I do note, Mr. Speaker, these are the questions that he was meant to ask last week. Perhaps I've got a bit of advice for him. If you're going to jump on a bandwagon, make sure it's still moving.
Mr. Speaker, no answers to the questions that people want answered. This is a Prime Minister, and we see a pattern of activity with him. A pattern of activity. He doesn't ask the tough questions of those around him, and when anything goes wrong, it's nothing to do with him. Now, what did he say in the ministerial code that he published? What did he say, Mr. Speaker? He said, it's not enough simply to make a difference. We must be different. And in the last 3 months, we've seen his Defence Secretary resign in disgrace and his spin doctor arrested. Is that what he meant by being different?
Yeah. It's a reference to Andy Coulson.
The right honourable gentleman seems to have failed to notice that the minister in question has resigned. Yeah. You're just a bit late.
That was an extract from Prime Minister's Questions Wednesday this week. Now, Martin, really what's happening there is he's saying, Ed Miliband is asking, you know, he wants a guarantee that there aren't similar arrangements with other ministers, and David Cameron really wasn't answering the question.
Yes, and of course Fox resigning means that the whole thing stops here, as Cameron wants it to stop here. If we look closely into the relationship between Fox, Werity, Mossad and various multimillionaires, we would start to see how our politics is being corrupted from the ground up by vested interests, foreign intelligence services and multimillionaires. And of course Cameron wants to stop it here. He wants the bandwagon to stop there, because if you look into what's going on, this government is bankrolled by foreign governments and by multimillionaires, and they don't want to admit it.
Okay, well, it's time to move on now, and we're now going to have a look at the Occupy Bristol camp, which has been set up, and it began last Saturday, as we announced on Friday's show, it was going to, right on College Green. I'm joined by Tom Baldwin from the Bristol and District's Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Tom, welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Can you just give us an idea of why you're involved in this Anti-Cuts Alliance? What's your interest in it?
Well, I mean, my interest is varied, to be honest. There's attacks on all different, you know, all different things that ordinary people rely upon. I mean, you know, my girlfriend works for the NHS. She's seen attempted privatisation of that. She faces paying an extra £70 or £80 a month into her pension, which is not something that we can afford. You know, I've got friends and relatives that use various different services. My gran, for example, has dementia. You know, there's all these kind of things that are being attacked. There's no one thing. And this is the sense that we actually are all in it together, which is that anyone other than the very, very wealthiest few in this country are coming under attack from this government. And, you know, that's why I'm trying to fight against that, basically.
So let's go down now to College Green, where I was earlier this week, and have a listen to Neil Masterson and Mark, who are both camping out on College Green at the moment.
My name's Nima Masterson. I'm a local resident living in inner city Bristol. I've been here for the last few days to join the Occupy Bristol movement here on College Green, which has grown out of an international movement that many people say began with the Arab Spring earlier this year. And last month on Wall Street, the movement grew, and on Saturday, an international day of action was formed, where in many major cities around the world, people began to form their own occupations in solidarity with what was happening in New York, and to express that this is actually a global issue where people all around the world are unhappy with the conditions of their lives, the structure of the system, the huge inequalities that are brought about. One phrase that is really being taken on is, we are the 99%. So we believe that we have massive public support, and we can see that the way that this movement is growing, that seems to be true in Bristol. It's unfolding very organically. We're having support from the unions, many members of the public, and it's really a chance for people who feel that they're not being listened to find a space in which we can express our voices, our frustrations, and our desires for better lives and a better world.
I'm Mark, and I'm also here down at Occupy Bristol. I mean, basically, my reason for being here is to send a clear message of defiance to central government and local government that I'm not going to remain silent anymore. I'm standing here in solidarity with those people who are unable to turn their electricity on because of the high prices. I'm here in solidarity for the people who are worried when they go to the supermarket because of the rising cost of food in the supermarket, with the people when they go to the petrol pump unable to fill the car up because of the rising petrol prices. I'm here in solidarity with workers who are getting flung onto the dole through no fault of their own. I'm here in solidarity with everybody who's getting screwed over at the moment to hopefully give a voice not only to myself, but hopefully for other people to jump on board with us. We've got Cameron there who went to Eton. You know what I mean? I didn't go to Eton. He's born into aristocracy. I certainly wasn't. I was born into a working class family in the northeast. He's there supposedly to represent me. You know, now the thing is, I can't relate to that guy, and he certainly can't relate to me.
Hundreds of years ago, people used to interact with each other much more and make decisions on a local level, and those decisions have been taken away from us. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I mean, that's it exactly. I mean, this is one of the hopes that I've had for this, is bring people together, because what's happened is there's been a barrier of fear instilled between us, and I believe that once that barrier of fear is removed, and we actually realise that, hang on a minute, we all have the same interests, we're all the same, we all want a decent life, we all want opportunities. When people actually come together and talk, we realise that we have a lot in common. But what's happened is, over the last 10 or 20 years, all that's been focused on in the mainstream media is our differences rather than what we actually have in common. And what I'm seeing over the last few days in this camp is a lot of people actually have the same views. We all want to see a clean up of the political system, we all want to see a clean up of the financial system, and we all want to see the clean up of the corporate abuses that have been going on. Abuses within the system we want to see cleaned up.
Yeah, I'd agree with what Mark's saying. Since the industrial ages, we have been educated to enter the workforce either as workers or supervisors or managers, but very divided, and divided inside as well. Our hands are often divorced from our brains, so you have the thinkers, the doers, you have the divisions between bosses and workers, you have the divisions between the police and society, local council and the people. So this is very much about how we can become less isolated, less atomized, how we can become less alienated. And what I've experienced here are people in Bristol, you know, we have a large culture of street drinkers, people who have really been alienated and marginalized from this society, and yet here they are finding feelings of self-worth and self-esteem here. And I think that's a very crucial element of us together building a society which is more whole, more unified.
If you're in Bristol, if you can identify with anything we've said, please come and join us, because you're welcome. We have businessmen here, we have unemployed people here, and we would like anybody, just come and join us and have your voice heard. Allow yourself just to come and speak and listen and talk and to share ideas and your hopes for the future, because that's what this is about.
Well, that was Nima Masterson and Mark speaking from the Occupy Bristol camp outside Bristol Cathedral and College Green. And as I said before, I'm also joined by Tom Baldwin from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Tom, what's your reaction to what you've heard there? It's something I would imagine you've got some sympathy for, especially since you're part of this Youth Fight Against Jobs. There's loads of young people down there.
Well, it's Youth Fight for Jobs, which again, is slightly different.
Sorry.
But yeah, no, we fully support what's happening with the Occupy Bristol movement, and you know what should be remembered is it's not just happening here in Bristol, but in many cities across the whole world actually. And it's a reflection, first of all, of not only the desperation that people feel about the situation they're in, but also their determination to go out and do something about it. And I think, you know, it's very impressive, particularly in the weather that we got at the moment, that people are camping out on College Green. And, you know, the slogans that they're raising, the idea of the 99% of, you know, ordinary people who didn't cause this crisis and yet are being made to pay the price for it. Well, you know, that kind of shows the kind of society we live in, really. The big class divide that exists between those who work, who create the wealth in society, and yet get very little back from it. And those tiny handful, it's not even 1%, actually, it's far, far less than that. A tiny handful of multi-billionaires that exploit us, that make money off of our backs, and yet are trying to make us pay for a crisis that they've caused.
Martin, do you want to just come in here, because some of the concerns that they're raising there are pretty basic ones. We're talking about energy prices, we're talking about food prices, and the fact that for many people, they're looking maybe towards a rise in benefits next April, but at the moment they're finding it very difficult to actually afford to feed themselves and also to pay the bills, basically.
We're in the most, as we were talking about Mervyn King saying, oh, this is the most serious crisis of modern times, and we're actually just at the beginning of it. It's going to get a lot worse, I'm afraid. We did at lunchtime today, I'm part of something called Bristol Speakers Corner, and we did a Speakers Corner event down at Occupy Bristol. We had a PA and a platform for people, and quite a lot of the occupiers took advantage of that. We'll be there next Friday lunchtime as well, if people are interested. There's also the demonstration by the disabled people that we heard about earlier, which will be happening tomorrow. I wish them every good luck. I think what's probably going to happen before
Christmas... But Martin, they're going to need more than luck, aren't they?
Oh, they're going to need a lot more than luck. They're going to need the support of the whole society. But there is about to be a banking crash. This will possibly happen before Christmas. It might happen in the new year. But if these people have got to have staying power, because once the capitalist system crashes, as I believe it will, then ordinary people are going to be forced to confront the reality.
But this sort of crisis, we're quite used in past decades of seeing this kind of thing in the developing world, where what they call IMF riots and massive structural changes going on at the same time. Is it fair to say that that's now something that's coming?
Yeah, what's been going on in the developing world for the last 30 years is about to happen to us. And basically, ordinary people who think that their lives are secure, their jobs are secure, their pensions are secure, their houses are secure, they are going to find that that's not the case. And we need massive political changes, and we've got to use every avenue that we can. And also, of course, we've got to stay united. And I think we stay united by recognising that there are different views, all sorts of different perspectives, people from different political groups, different political parties, but there's got to be a united front against the oligarchy, which has basically stolen our country.
And Tom, I know you're planning something like a new Jarrow March. Can you tell us, first of all, what the original Jarrow March was about?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was 75 years ago. It was a march of 200 unemployed men from the Tyneside town of Jarrow all the way down to London, to protest about both very high levels of unemployment, but also about the treatment of unemployed people at that time. That you know, was a success in terms of the support that it raised, the fact that it spread that message, wasn't a success in terms of the fact that when they got to London, the then Prime Minister, you know, refused to meet them, and they ended up getting not much more than their train fare home as a result of it. But, you know, still it's kind of stood the test of time as something that people still talk about.
So when's that happening? When are you doing this?
Well, we're right now, members of Youth Fight for Jobs are marching in the footsteps of the original Jarrow Crusaders to raise the fact that once again, you know, unemployment, particularly amongst young people, but not exclusively, is a growing blight upon our society, and that the government is, you know, attempting to reduce the amount of benefits that they get, and, you know, make it harder to claim benefits as well. And so, you know, they're marching at the moment. They're due to arrive into London on the 5th of November, but we've actually got some of the marchers as part of the route visiting Bristol. Well, they're coming on Sunday night. We're having a fundraising gig to welcome them at the Grain Barge at 8 o'clock.
Can you just tell us where the Grain Barge is?
Yeah, sorry, that's on Mardyke Wharf in Hotwells. That's, if you want the postcode, BS84RU. We've also then, on the Monday night, that's this coming Monday, the 24th, at 7 o'clock, there's a public meeting, again, for people to meet the marchers, but also to hear more about what we're doing and why. That's, like I say, 7 o'clock on Monday at the City of Bristol College, the College Green campus of that.
Okay, and if people want to find out more, are you on the internet? How do we do that?
We are, yeah. You can visit youthfightforjobs.com. There's also a blog kind of the some of the marchers, which is Jarrow March 11. That's 1-1 in figures, jarrowmarch11.com.
Well, Tom Baldwin from Bristol and District's Anti-Cuts Alliance. Is there a website for the Anti-Cuts Alliance too?
There is. It's bristolanticutsalliance.org.uk, and we meet monthly in the Friends Meeting House on Champion Square. That's the first Monday of every month at 7:30 p.m. It's a broad grouping that brings together people fighting all the different cuts that aims to unite those. Like I say, we support the people from Occupy Bristol, etc. So people are more than welcome to come to those meetings.
Right, well, Tom Baldwin, thanks very much. And I'll give the final word to you, Martin. What do you think about this whole Jarrow March business?
Well, I think the original Jarrow March, of course, was successful in publicity terms, but it didn't do anything to change government policy. I think what we've got to aim to do is get this coalition government out. We're not waiting until 2014.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, finally, as the NHS is privatised, an organisation has been set up to support health service whistleblowers. It's called SWHAG, S-W-W-H-A-G, that's Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. And patients and members of the public have joined forces to form this independent advocacy group. They've been actively involved in NHS service changes, bringing an intelligent questioning approach to representing patient and public interest. SWHAG's remit is to make the care and safety of patients our first concern, they say, and act to protect them from risk, shine the light in also to dark NHS crevices, and also be a champion of improvements in NHS services. You can find SHAG on the website, SWHAG, I must pronounce it correctly, the website swhag.wordpress.com. You can also contact them on email, which is swhistleblowers@gmail.com, and there's also a phone number, 07971 968 244, and they're also on Twitter, so they're also very much tooled up with all this social networking stuff. Twitter.com hashtag and then slash SWWHAG, but probably the website is the easiest one to contact them on. Martin, what's the point of this whistleblowing business?
Well, I mean, obviously, as this, let's call it what it is. It is a privatisation of the health service, although if we had a Conservative on here, they'd probably deny it. There's going to be all kinds of scandals are going to come out as a result of what happens, and we need to be people to be vigilant.
And we'll have more about whistleblowing in future weeks. That's all the serious talk out of the way tonight. It was After the Sky News at 7. Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That was Derek Pickup, and also to Tara Melton and Jenny Hodges, and also Tom Baldwin. Next week, Roy Carr from the